On Monday, August 8th, Tall Can Audio hits 1,000 episodes.
Wait, that's still on? Who could possibly still care?
And the gang is all here to celebrate.
It's euphoric. It's got to be close to nirvana. It's outstanding.
For the first time ever, Maddie, Michaela, Rob, and Matt are all live in studio together.
It's happening, you guys! It's happening! Oh, my God, guys! Oh, my God! I wish you all were here!
Is this likely to go well?
Just check my notes here. No!
At least it will make a lot of noise.
Boom. Here comes the boom.
1,000 pods and 1,000 pints.
I don't think I've ever been as proud in my entire life.
TCA 1000 drops Monday, August 8th, wherever you find low-quality podcasts.
Fuck, it's out of control. Shit.
Let's do this!
1, 2, 3, 4. A swing and a belt. Left field. Way back. Blue Jays win it.
Oh, God. Down the sideline. Wow. Touchdown.
Unbelievable.
Try to finish it.
It's over.
Here's a chance. That call. Shot rebound. Score.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to TCS number 278. Matt Robinson here with you on the Tall Can Audio Podcast Network. You can give us a follow on Twitter at Tall Can Audio, facebook.com/TallCanAudio. And just this week, we've got set up a new Instagram account. So if you're into that sort of thing, as we try and keep up with the cool kids, you can hit us up there. Also at Tall Can Audio. Great guest today. Really excited to have Sean McKindo on with us. Sean is better known to most of you, at least in the online hockey community, as Down Goes Brown. You can give him a follow on Twitter if you'd like, at Down Goes Brown. And he's got a new book out this week. It's called The Down Goes Brown History of the NHL. And I'm about halfway through. It's been a great read so far. I'm really enjoying it. If you want, you can pick it up in bookstores, or you could pick it up on Amazon. If you're going to do that, I would ask, you can support the show by visiting tallcanaudio.com. And in the show notes for this, and just really if you click on the link wherever we post this on Facebook or Twitter, it will take you to this episode's page on tallcanaudio.com, and there will be a link there to the book on Amazon. And you click that link, you buy the book at the same price that you always would have, but Amazon gives us a little kickback. It's an easy way to support the show, and they kind of reward us for sending you there. On that page, you'll be able to buy it in, you can get the hardcover if that's your thing. You can also get the audio version while you're there, or even on your Kindle if you prefer to read that way on your tablet or on your phone. All of it will be, like I said, at tallcanaudio.com on the page for TCS 278. It's a great way to buy Sean's book, which has been a great read, and it gives us, like I said, just a little bit of a kickback. So without any further ado, let's get to it. Sean McKindo, Down Goes Brown, on the Tall Can Sports Podcast.
Hits with one, throwing right hands at Lefebvre. Another right hand by Brown. Lefebvre gets an uppercut. Down goes Brown! Down goes Brown! And Lefebvre leaves him there.
TKO.
Robbie Brown down like he was shot.
So as promised, I want to welcome to the show Sean McKindo, better known to most of you as Down Goes Brown. He's got a new book out this week, The Down Goes Brown History of the NHL. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I guess my first question is did you know when you were putting this thing out that you would be putting a book out within the same week as one of the most beloved Maple Leafs of all time, Curtis Joseph?
You know what? I did not. And if I had, I probably would have changed the timing up, because he's everywhere right now. I went took the kids to the bookstore last night so they could see Dad's book, and it was just wall to wall Cujo. So I'm not saying that I'm bitter at all, but I may have spent some time watching Mike Foligno YouTube clips just to because Cujo is he's a tough one to go up against.
No doubt. So I guess maybe if you could take a minute and just kind of you've had sort of an unusual career path. I know you were kind of a 9-to-5er with a blog and a Twitter account, and eventually were able to turn it into freelance. Now you're with The Athletic. Can you just kind of walk our listeners through your path here a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, growing up, I loved sports. I loved writing. I thought it would be very cool to be a sports writer. And I went to college, got a degree in journalism, did kind of the typical sports writer in training type of thing, wrote for the school paper and all of that stuff. Got to the end of that and got my degree. And I just, you know, I realized as I went that I loved the writing. I didn't love the reporting. Okay. And I didn't love the idea of spending the next decade or so, you know, kind of doing the, you know, it's a tough path, or at least, you know, in those days, the path to get anywhere in the world of reporting was a real tough one. You know, it meant moving around a lot. It meant taking a lot of assignments you might not necessarily want to take. It was, you know, it was this tough path, and I wasn't really convinced that this was actually what I wanted to do. And so the opportunity opened up to go and take a pretty good job doing a different type of writing, doing marketing stuff for a software company. And I jumped on that, and that I ended up working at that company for 14 years. And it was a good job, and I liked the people and all of that. But I always still had this itch for the writing side. And you know, it kind of, you know, I was the guy who would like write the season preview for the Fantasy Football League. That was okay. Just like a little bit too long and a little bit too in depth, and sure. You know, and like sending it out, and like 8 people would read it, and you know, and that was fine because it was fun for me. I like, you know, the writing was fun, but about 10 years ago, when blogs suddenly start becoming a thing, and it becomes clear that anybody, you don't need any sort of technical know-how, you don't need any audience, you can just set up this, you know, you can set up your own blog and write. And you can reach your audience of 8 people that way. And so I ended up doing that. And eventually the audience went from 8 to 80, and eventually all the way up to, you know, maybe 800. And it just kind of went from there. And I was able to build an audience of readers and to build an audience, you know, through social media and eventually putting my work in front of some people who were already in the media industry, and that led to small opportunities at first, but eventually I was able to make it into at least a part-time job, or maybe a better way to put it was a hobby that was bringing money in, instead of like most hobbies where the money goes the other way.
For sure.
I got laid off from my day job a week before Christmas in 2012, at a time when the NHL was in another one of its lockouts, and there wasn't really anyone who was all that interested in reading about hockey coverage. Mm-hmm. But shortly after that, the lockout ended, and some places went to look to expand their coverage, and I was extremely fortunate that I was able to latch on with a website called Grantland, which of course was the Bill Simmons project over at ESPN.
That was terrific. Yeah.
One of the, just the best sports writing websites of all time. And you know, I've said before that when I joined there first as a part-timer and then ultimately as a full-time writer, I mean, it felt to me like I would look around at the other people working at that site, and I felt like this must be what it would have felt like to be a fourth line winger on the 1979 Canadiens, where you're just looking around and it's Hall of Famer, All-Star, Hall of Famer, and then it's you, and you're just sitting there going, man, I just want to get out there and not embarrass myself too badly.
Sure.
And I got to do that for a couple of years. Best job I've ever had. It was fantastic. That site closed in 2015. I spent a few years doing freelance, which actually went very, very well. I wasn't sure about that, but I ended up latching on. Specifically, I did most of my work with Vice Sports as well as Sportsnet, who were two great sites that I was treated very well, and again, was working with great people. And then this summer, the opportunity presented itself to make the jump over to the Athletic, and so I'm there now, and it's early days, but again, you know, really enjoying myself, and really kind of getting some of that Grantland feeling back, where it's you look around at some of the names that they've been able to add over the last few years, and it's pretty phenomenal. So it's been a weird path. It's been not a traditional one at all. I get asked sometimes by journalism students, like, how do I get where you get? And I have to tell them, like, don't follow my path, because this isn't the way it's supposed to work.
Sure.
But I've been extraordinarily fortunate and lucky, and time after time along the way, just had the ball bounce my way. And I'm here, and it's led to the opportunity to do side projects like this book, and it's fun, and I'm enjoying every minute of it.
So how does the book come about? It's the book's called The Down Goes Brown: History of the NHL. It's available now in bookstores. If you can get past Sean and his kids that are admiring the cover, you can pick it up there, or you can get on Amazon or Audible. I got the audiobook version. I want to ask you about that experience shortly, but where does the idea come from? There's been other publications that covered the history of the league, none of them with your slant, I guess, if we want to call it that. I can remember my parents, when I was a kid, got me this huge, it was like 6 video cassettes long, called like The Legends of Hockey, and it was all these segments with all these old players, but it was very dry, right? So how does the idea kind of come about for you to tackle this from a different angle? And was it nerve-wracking to look at it and go, what can I say that hasn't been said yet? Or do you go into it looking for these kind of cool stories? Or how does it come about? How long have you kind of been plugging away at it?
Yeah, I mean, I've always loved the history. I mean, even as a kid, I had those books, and I was often as interested in the stuff that had happened way back in the past as what was happening at that time. And that's probably somewhat related to growing up as a Maple Leafs yes. fan in the Harold Ballard era, where there's you're just kind of like, I can't deal with what's happening right now.
I'm gonna go look at when this team was good.
Exactly. So. I was always interested in that, and knowing that the centennial season was coming along for the NHL, and that there was going to be this sort of renewed interest in all the history that had gone with it, I had pitched this idea to some of the publishers out there that I would like to do a history of the NHL book, and the feedback that we tended to get initially was people would say, that's a great idea, but it's a great idea that a lot of other people are already doing. And there have already been lots of great books about the history of the NHL. There's going to be more as the centennial comes out.
Right.
Why would people want to read another one? And my answer to that was always that I am not going to write a book that's in that same style as other people are doing. And the way I kind of described it is that I have no interest in writing a textbook. And that sounds derogatory, and I don't intend it that way. There are lots of people who have written really fantastic books about the history of the NHL that just cover all the details and teach you everything that you need to know.
Pretty straight-laced.
Yeah. Which is a perfectly valid way to do
sure
it. And it's, as I say, they've done it really well. They've done it far better than I could ever do it. If people are familiar with my work and my writing, I tend to take things from a little bit of a different perspective. Number one, I always look at things from a fan's perspective. I've never been someone who believes that if you're going to write about hockey, you have to just sever the cord of your fandom and approach it completely objectively as a separate experience from being a fan. I am a hockey fan. I always have been. I always will be. And that's reflected in my writing. And that gives me a little bit of a different perspective and a little bit of leeway to come at things from a different angle and go in some different directions than maybe a more traditional sports writer would. And the other thing is I look at a lot of this stuff with a sense of humor. A lot of the stuff I write is tongue in cheek. A lot of it is focused on the absurd and the weird and the strange. And I do that because that's how I view hockey. I love hockey. I have my whole life. but this is not religion. This is not life and death.
Right.
This is a silly game that we watch because it's entertaining and because it's fun. And because after a long, hard day's work, you come home and this is a way to kind of unwind for a couple of hours. And that's all that it is. That's how I've always viewed it. And I know even when I was a little kid, I was always as interested in the weird aspects of the history and the kind of funny stuff that had happened as anything else, you know, like when you're sitting there watching a game and it's 7-1 and the announcers have just completely run out of things to talk about and then suddenly you'll hear that, you know, the color guy will be like, this reminds me of that time back in the 60s where the Penguins went into St. Louis and they all wore earmuffs for the game because the crowd was too loud. And oh, there's an icing. Okay, we'll be back after this break. And you're sitting there going like, no, go back to the earmuff thing. What right. The hell are you talking about? That couldn't really have happened.
Right.
And it did. And, you know, and I would pick up kind of those stories along the way. So what I've done here is I've written a book on the history and it covers all the important stuff. I felt very strongly that I was not just going to do, you know, here's all the goofy stuff that's happened in the NHL. I really did want to cover all the important stuff, all the glory, the records, the tragedies, all of that is in there. But I also wanted to do it with an emphasis on kind of the weird and wacky and the stuff that even if you've read all of those other great books on the history of the NHL, you probably haven't heard a lot of these stories and certainly haven't heard them in any kind of detail. I think that fans out there will like it. I'm hoping and betting that there are a lot of fans out there who kind of approach the game the same way I do, where they want to know this stuff and they want to learn this stuff. And you certainly will learn things from the book, but they also just want to come away with some of those weird stories and you can have in your back pocket. And then next time you're sitting around with your hockey fan friends at a game or at a bar or at the water cooler, you can throw one of these stories out and go like, did you guys ever hear about the earmuff story? And then they'll look at you like, what the hell are you talking about?
Right.
And you can drop the story on them. So, that's always been the kind of thing that appealed to me. That's what I wanted to do. That's what I pitched them. Luckily enough, somebody said yes. And then I had to figure out how the hell I was going to actually pack 100 years of history into 250 pages or so, which was a nice problem to have. And a couple of years later, here we are. And the thing is actually on store shelves, or at least on those shelves that are not being currently occupied by Curtis Joseph.
I can certainly vouch for that. I consider myself reasonably knowledgeable about the history of the league, but there was tons of stories I'd never heard before that either made you laugh or, as you kind of alluded to, scratched your head and go, what the hell? And I think to the way you, just your style of recounting the story of who was going to get Gilbert Perreault, right? In terms of,
yeah,
we could have just flipped a coin, but no, we're going to use the wheel, but we'll flip a coin to see who spins the wheel. And just little things like that, right, that make me laugh. And there's sections in between each chapter called, I believe you called them Strange But True. And there was all kinds of gold in there. So to me, it's been a great read so far. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the experience of doing the audiobook. I've heard it can be hellacious to sit and have to do these perfect takes and read your own work. I wonder, do you find yourself cringing at the way you worded something as you're the one who goes back and read it? Do you have to stop because you've cracked yourself up or remembered one of these stories? What's the experience like of having to go back and read your own work, knowing how many people are going to listen?
I got to tell you, it was a very interesting experience and very strange. And I have to be honest here. This is going to make me sound like a dummy, but when they first kind of reached out to me this summer and said, we would like to do an audible or like an audio version of your book. And I said, that's awesome. Who are you going to get to read it? And they said, well, no, you're not. They said, you don't understand. You're nowhere. We would like to do an audio version, but you're nowhere near important enough for us to go out and get somebody famous. So if this is going to happen, you need to read it yourself. Would you be willing to do that? And I said, of course I would. And honest to God, when that was happening, in my head, I pictured myself doing what I'm doing right now, which is like sitting at my dining room table in front of my laptop and my microphone and just reading the book into some audio file that they would just take and use. And
right.
It is a much more involved process than that. I had to go to a studio. I had a director. I had a producer. I had to sit in a little room with the big, you know, microphone with the screen in front of it and the headphones. And the part that was, I don't want to say frustrating, but the part that was a challenge for me personally was the thing that I learned is that when you're sitting there and reading this book, you've got to read every word exactly as it is written in the book. If I say, you know, if the book says Wayne Gretzky scored 5 goals and the Edmonton Oilers won that game, and I read Wayne Gretzky scored 5 goals and the Edmonton Oilers won the game, somebody comes on in my ear and says, no, it's not the, it's that, you have to do it again. And I understand why this is, but I mean, there were times where they say, well, we have to do it exactly that way because we have to make sure that we are completely true to the author's words. And I'm like, but I am the author. I'm allowed to change the words. Can we just, and you can't. So it has to be absolutely perfect. And I'm always somebody where I don't like being corrected. I'm the sort of guy where I'm like, if you know what I mean, you don't need to jump in and tell me,
And corrected on my own words.
On my own words, yeah, exactly. And plus, I'm sitting there just, you know, when I write, I love to write long, flowery sentences with lots of semicolons and
sure.
M dashes, and I'd like to think that it reads great, but when you're sitting there going, oh my God, I gotta, like, this next sentence is like, dude, it's like 100 words. I can't do this in one breath.
Right.
Work in a period, man, because they make you do it sentence by sentence. You know, you make a mistake, you don't just start and redo that word. You have to go back to the beginning of the sentence or the paragraph. So I would just be sitting there cursing myself. Like, I mean, if I ever do another book, people are going to be wondering, like, why is every sentence in this book like 5 words long? Why is it? And it's going to be because of that, in case I ever have to do this again. Because I learned so much about breathing and, you know, voice control and my energy levels, and I'm sitting there having to eat apples and drink honey tea and all of this stuff to keep the voice strong.
Right.
And I learned about lots of words that I cannot pronounce or did not know how to pronounce, or words that I say wrong.
They're fun to write, but I don't actually have to say them.
Yeah. I mean, half of this stuff, I mean, there's names in this book that I've written and read a million times. I've never said them out loud.
Right.
And so we'd have to figure out how that, or I learned the one that kept getting me was I could not for the life of me say the Detroit Red Wings as part of a sentence. And my director, who's done a lot of voice acting work, actually explained to me. She said, yeah, that is common, because when you say the and then duh right after them, the, your tongue has to go out, duh, your tongue has to go back and hit the top of your mouth, and it just messes your mouth up. And what would happen for me is I could say the Detroit Red Wings, but then if there was anything else after it, I was just a mess.
I'm spent.
And exactly. And, you know, and you're sitting there going, like, how can you not say the Detroit? And I got to tell you, it's a book about NHL history. The Detroit Red Wings show up a few times
right.
in this book. And there was, there were times where I'm in the booth reading, and I'm reading, but I'm also looking ahead. And you just see this long run-on sentence that would end with the Detroit Red Wings. And I'd just be like, oh, screw me. I think my record was like 5 or 6 takes for a single sentence, which, you know, just it's. I feel bad for the producer and the director, because there's only so many ways you can tell somebody they just said something wrong before you're basically calling them an idiot,
right?
Over and over again, and in a very friendly way. And they were total pros, and they did a fantastic job. But they're stuck there listening to this poor dummy in a booth who wrote a book about the history of the NHL but can't say the Detroit Red Wings.
Well, that's so funny, eh? Because you'd think it'd be a Krushelnitsky or a Borshevsky or some crazy Russian name, but it's the Detroit Red Wings, and it's going to come up over and over and over.
There's a whole chapter that is nothing but the Detroit Red Wings and Colorado Avalanche rivalry, and I'm like, can we just skip this? Would they notice if we... And again, I would say to them, like, what, can I just say the Red Wings? Like, I'm pretty sure no one's confused that
right.
in 1987 we're referring to some other team. And they'd be like, nah, you can't. Like, the publisher will make you do it again.
I'm giving you the abridged version. That's what's coming.
Exactly.
How long do you think you were in there? How long did the process take?
I think we did a total of 8 days in the studio, and a day would be 4 or 5 hours.
Wow.
Because that was about as long as I could last for my voice, which was also a very weird experience, because I'd be, you know, we'd be 4 hours in And I wasn't tired. I was ready. Let's go. Let's get another chapter done. But then I'd get in there and the voice would just not be there.
Sure.
And they'd have to say, you know, we're shutting it down. So yeah, it was a big chunk of the summer was spent on this. And as far as listening to back, I never did. I didn't have to do that. They because I'm in the booth, I can't hear what they're listening back to.
Right.
My wife this week got the audio version and she's like walking around listening to it. And I'm like, don't put on some headphones or something.
Sure.
I do not need to hear my own voice and relive that experience. So.
Right. Well, maybe if this one's big enough on your next one, they'll get Morgan Freedman or somebody in to cover this one for you. But I wanted to ask
Bob Cole
that. Hey, there you go. By the sounds of it, he's going to be looking for stuff to do here pretty shortly. I wanted to ask you, because I got you here, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you something about the Leafs, but it's not going to be current day. I've always wondered, there's this reverence around the Leafs fans for the kind of 93-94 era Leafs back-to-back conference finals. It's Wendell, it's Dougie, and you know, if we're going to celebrate these teams that only go as far as the conference finals, I always wondered why there was never the same reverence for, you know, later on in 99 and 02, we had another couple of conference finals, some really good teams. I believe one of them won the East in the regular season with Sundin and Roberts and McGillney and that whole gang. Why do you think those guys are not quite remembered as fondly as, even though they accomplished the exact same thing as the 93-94 Leafs?
Yeah, I mean, in some sense they should be, because they really, you know, those were the best teams mm-hmm. of my lifetime for the Leafs.
Sure.
Those Pat Quinn teams that he put together, you know, those are, until potentially the present day Leafs, those yeah. are the only Leaf teams really that you could look at and say, this team absolutely can win the Stanley Cup. And even, you know, even that 2004 team where, you know, Ferguson came, took over, they made the Brian Leach trade, and there's this kind
of the Francis Leach Leafs.
Yeah, there's this kind of revisionist history that, oh, you know, that was an old team and they didn't know. That was a great team. That team absolutely could have won the Cup. They just happened to run into another team that could win the Cup in the second round and they got knocked out. The thing with the 93 team is it's the context of it. And I understand very well that for people who are outside of Toronto or who are not Leaf fans, this all seems very strange, that Leaf fans will not shut up about this team from 25 years ago that just – won two rounds. I mean, that 93 team, they actually, I mean, they finished one game over 500 in the playoffs. I mean, they went 11-10.
Right.
And, you know, why are we still, but you have to understand the context and you have to understand the complete and utter hopelessness of being a Maple Leafs fan in the Harold Ballard era.
Yeah,
and
okay.
for me, like I came into it, you know, in the 80s. But even before then, you know, the 70s team and the falling out with Daryl Sittler and trading away Lanny McDonald and all of this stuff going on because the owner was this crazy, you know, guy who wouldn't spend money and wouldn't, you know, didn't seem to care about winning. And just this feeling where you go through, I mean, the Maple Leafs went through the entire decade of the 1980s, never even finishing 500. You know, this feeling as a sports fan, there is no worse feeling in sports than, you know, you can handle a team being bad. You can even handle a team being bad for a while, but this feeling that it will never get better and that your team doesn't matter. Your team is only there to be the team on the wrong end of the highlight reels for other teams.
Sure.
And when you have an owner who just doesn't care, and there, it just never seems to get any better. And this feeling that, like, that's it. We're a punchline. We are a joke. That is all it is. And you know, especially when it's a team like the Leafs have been around for so long. It's such a part of your blood and identity. If you grow up in Toronto, or if your parents and grandparents are Leaf fans, you can't just abandon them. But you're just stuck with these losers. and then finally, you know, happy day. Harold Ballard finally dies. And Cliff Fletcher arrives and then Pat Burns arrives and suddenly you feel like something's being built, but you don't want to get your hopes up because you've just, I mean, it's been 15 years of misery, and then they go on this ride and not only go on this long playoff run, but with this perfect cast of characters. Like, you couldn't script it any better. The first line center, who's this really cool guy with the hair and everything, and then, you know, you got the winger who's always punching people in the face, and he's great, toughest guy in the league, and the goalie who never says anything, and, you know, it's like a cast out of a movie. And just to go on that run, the city of Toronto was already riding this wave from the Blue Jays. So it was like, suddenly, like, this can be fun. This can be positive again. And it was, it was just, I don't think you'll ever recapture, even the next year, the 94 run where they went to the conference final again, isn't viewed the same way. Cause it was, you know, for a lot of us, this literally was our first time having a hockey team that we could like and enjoy and not feel like we were destined for it to end miserably. And you know, when they go again in 99, I think by then a lot of people sort of took it for granted, you know, like, oh yeah, we're going to the conference final again. Great.
Right.
By 2002, you know, that a lot of that team, was maybe not the most likable, and that kind of thing. But, you know, by 2002, this was the fourth time in a decade. And it was kind of like, okay, yeah, this is just kind of what happens in Toronto now. And of course it wasn't, and they've never been back. And maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe for today's fans, maybe there's somebody, you know, I was a teenager in that 93 run. Maybe there's fans out there who are teenagers right now where this Leafs team, if they can go on a bit of a run, will look back on it the same way and feel about it the same way. But, because they've grown up in the Brian Burke and John Ferguson and Dave Nonis era where nobody could win anything, and you had that feeling of hopelessness coming again. But, I've always said one thing I can't stand about modern hockey culture is this idea that if you don't win the cup, it's failure. And that's it. If you don't get the ring, nothing else matters. And, you know, we hear from GMs that there's every year 30 teams don't win the cup. There's more to it than just winning a cup. And it's okay to enjoy a playoff run that doesn't end in a cup or a season that doesn't end in a cup, because otherwise, what a terrible way to market a product.
Sure.
Like, you know, hey, come watch the NHL. There's a 97% chance that it's going to end in failure and misery. Nobody's going to watch that. So I go ahead, embrace that 93 team, it's the most fun I've ever had as a hockey fan. And, I would love to see a cup someday and knock that 93 team down to number two. It was a great team. They were lots of fun. They went on a hell of a playoff ride, and they kicked Curtis Joseph in the face during overtime of a playoff game. So they checked all the boxes that I'm looking for.
Okay. You know what? I think you make an interesting point that part of it is you're a teenager. You know, you watch hockey as a kid, and I'm a little younger than you, so my teenage years were those 99 to 02 teams, right? So I'm falling in love with it, but I'm also understanding a bit more of it. And so to me, those are the more prominent memories than 93, where I'm, you know, 9 or 10 years old. And so it's an interesting thing. And I think you make a good point that for a lot of people, it's been a decade of sadness, and there's teenagers now just getting their first chance to enjoy it with this new Austin Matthews team. As we wind this down, I want to get back to the book. There was one story I really enjoyed. I hoped you might share it with our listeners here just before we get out of here. The Buffalo Sabres went a little over the top in, I believe it was the late 70s, in drafting internationally. And it was really just out of frustration to end the draft. I wondered if you might share that story with our listeners.
So, sure. Yeah, this is back in the 70s. The NHL draft was very weird back in the 70s. It wasn't the kind of professional big operation that it is today. And one of the differences in the 70s was that there was no set limit on how long the draft could go. You could just keep drafting as long as you wanted. It's basically the draft ended when everybody was done and everybody passed. So you could have these situations where the draft just kept going and going and going, and most of the teams wanted to go home, but a couple of teams wanted to keep going, and they would just keep drafting and drafting. And so eventually what happens is in the mid-70s, one of these drafts is going on, and the Buffalo Sabres are getting a little bit frustrated because – it's just going on forever. And so their GM, Punch Imlach, decides that he's going to have a bit of fun, and that if the NHL is going to let this draft keep going and going, that he's going to enjoy himself a bit. And so he steps to, I guess, not the microphone, the the telephone, probably, because they're just doing it all on conference call. And he announces that they are drafting a player from the Japanese Hockey League. And he announces that they're drafting a Taro Sugimoto, I think would be the pronunciation.
That had to be one that held you up in the audio studio.
Oh, that was absolutely, absolutely. And the reason it held me up is because normally when you have a tough name to pronounce, you can just say, well, how did the real person pronounce it? And we can't do that in this situation, because in addition to being the first Japanese hockey player drafted in the NHL, the other interesting thing about Taro Sugimoto is that he does not exist. He is a fictional invention of the Buffalo Sabres that they came up with just to screw with the NHL. And they announced that they had drafted him from like the Tokyo Katanas, which probably should have been a hint, right? Katanas are Japanese sabers, like that maybe should have. But at the time they draft him, and I mean, this is before the internet. This is before everyone, you know, had scouts everywhere, and people were kind of scratching their heads going, nobody's ever heard of this guy. But it was assumed that the Sabres had, you know, pulled off a little bit of a scouting
hidden gem somewhere.
Exactly. And the funny thing about it is, it's not like they drafted this guy and then said, no, we're just kidding. They didn't own up to it that day or the next day. They kept this going until like training camp. And like, there's reporters in Buffalo who are like, when's the Japanese kid getting here? We got to interview this guy. This is going to be a great story. And it wasn't until like the eve of training camp that they finally fessed up and said, this guy doesn't exist. He's completely made up. I don't even think the team existed.
We were bored at the draft.
The league might have. Yeah, we were bored at the draft. Your draft takes too damn long. So screw you. We're going to, we drafted a fictional player. And the league was not amused. They vacated the pick. So if you look in the official record books, you will not see this player listed. It's just listed as if they passed the pick. But it's one of those great moments where you have a guy who, you know, an NHL team officially, formally in a real NHL draft, just being like, screw this. We're taking somebody who doesn't exist just so we can mess with everybody. and then sticks with the bit for months to come after that until they finally have to confess.
That might be my favorite story that I've come across thus far in the book. It's called The Down Goes Brown, History of the NHL. It is in bookstores. It's on Amazon. You can get it on Audible. You can have it on your Kindle. What am I missing? Where else can they get the book?
You can get it pretty much anywhere. I mean, it's a wide release, so it should be in just about all of the stores and certainly anywhere that you get your books online. It should have it there. If you're looking for it somewhere and you can't find it, hit me up on Twitter at Down Goes Brown. Let me know. I'll see if I can go smack someone in the head and make sure that it's available to you. But
probably just fell in behind the Cucho book. It's there.
It's probably. I mean, blame Curtis Joseph. He's taken over. But it should be anywhere and in any format that you prefer to do your reading in, or you can listen to me read it to you. and try to guess which sentences I had to say three or four times to get right.
And we will link to it in the show notes at tallcanaudio.com. So if all else fails, you'll be able to find it there. Sean McKindo, thank you very much for doing this. Appreciate your time. The book's been a great read thus far. I think people are going to enjoy it.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
All right, there he goes. That is Sean McKindo, Down Goes Brown. Great to have him on the podcast. Some awesome stories in this book, including the one about the Sabres and the Tokyo Katanas, which I think has been my favorite thus far in the book. Really appreciate Sean taking a little time for us. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so on Twitter at Tall Can Audio, or if you're still doing the Facebook thing, we are over there at facebook.com/tallcanaudio. We also have a Patreon page if that's your deal. It's patreon.com/tallcanaudio. Go figure, right? Just one more reminder. Like I said, if you're going to pick up the book, it is The Down Goes Brown, History of the NHL. And if you're planning to buy it in either audio or hardcover or Kindle format on Amazon, we'd love it if you would consider visiting our page first, anywhere that this is posted on Facebook, on Twitter, or just go to tallcanaudio.com and click on the page for this episode, which is TCS 278. And you just click on the link to the book there, and it will take you directly to the Amazon page where you can pick the format you want and pay the same price you were always going to pay on Amazon anyway. But Amazon gives us just a little bit of a kickback to support the show for sending you there. So with that in mind, this has been Tall Can Sports 278 on the Tall Can Audio Podcast Network, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Listening. You can get more TCA at tallcanaudio.com or by searching Tall Can Audio on your favorite podcast app.